That was very exciting. I mean, all three projects, or five contributors, thank you very much. And I think it is a challenge for us to sit here and now talk about the subject of this particular session. But I do have actually a variety of questions. Some of them are addressed to all of you, and some of them are very, very particular. Now, what I really enjoy is your, and that's like for you too, your engagement and your direct work and collaboration with other disciplines. When I talk about other disciplines, I actually do mean biologists and people who architects have never ever thought about working together with, and a lot of architects, scholars and students still think that interdisciplinarity means to start working with an engineer at the beginning of a project, or an artist or a dancer. I think that's more 1956. So I'm very, very happy that you do this, that you show this, that you promote this. And as architects, obviously we are asked to, well, we are kind of still asked to produce buildings. And then we're coming to an issue of scale. So you're working in biology, growing mushrooms, growing material, which is probably sound, but then we are dealing with building envelopes. And so there's one question: how, or do we actually need to ask the question at this moment in time, how do we implement it? And a second question for all of you who are teaching, how do we implement this sort of practice of architectural research, and I think it's starting to be real research, into a curriculum which is very, very close to the curriculum of not just the last century, but more the one before. Maybe, do you want to start?
Sure. It doesn't pull. Gotta go. All right.
I think
as Michael pointed out, the this kind of emergence between architecture and other species has been around for hundreds of years. I mean,
But it's not been implemented.
Yeah. It's at some point we there is the nuisance issue, which was something that was brought up, but the fantasy of a connected biological world, at least in drawing and many forms of models, Greg Lynn's embryological house, et cetera, Gaudi alluding to other kinds of things built into the stone. It's the direction as a kind of a spearhead or trajectory of thinking in architecture, at least for me, has been has just been around since almost the dawn of architecture. Not that we can always solve it by immediately looking to the natural world and mimicking those things. Sometimes it's very hard. There's this desire to look at spiders and how they produce webs and getting the same kind of strength that you would receive at room temperature from a little biological organism with basically water and eating some bugs and creating this incredible web-like material, the spider silk. And there's laboratories are out there working to do something like that. And I believe someone had a breakthrough. But it's been a constant inspiration. Some of that work didn't come from architecture. It's not like I have the answer. I just know that we're in it, and working through it is vital.
Yeah, I do agree with that. I'm just saying that to be an inspiration is not enough. Yeah. And maybe to extend my question or comment to Jeffrey, you showed a project which dealt with the blurring of the figure ground. Why the heck do you want to blur a figure ground? Just for the sake of blurring? No, the question is, what kind of parameters do you use? So are these connected also to nature, but not just as an inspiration, which then relates also to parametrics maybe? So maybe I just open this conversation to you guys.
Yeah, I think I know what you're kind of getting at there, but Yeah, I think that there is a kind of close relationship to, let's say, the parametric question that you're trying to kind of pose there. I always like these kind of little pauses right now. They kind of caught me on this one.
Let me be more direct. What were the parameters for you to arrive at this particular geometry beyond the desire to blur the figure
well,
ground?
Well, the thing is, like, the figure ground and the kind of the aim to kind of blur it is one thing in order to kind of try and actually have a kind of more cohesive nature relationship between the kind of parameters of what is initially the kind of ground, and then what is initially going to be the kind of the figure itself within it. Within some of the kind of parameters within the kind of geometrical kind of relationships, those start to kind of take on board, let's say within the kind of master plan project that I was showing. They would take on board more environmental conditions. So it's less about the ground, but more about the kind of ecosystems that surround it that are kind of particular to that location, for instance. Like being, let's say, the master plan in Reykjavik, that one. You have a kind of condition where you're kind of dealing with hurricane force winds on a kind of regular basis as a kind of key parameter. So that actually starts to kind of generate or delineate where the kind of vertical kind of height of those that overall kind of landscape it comes from. Also the kind of limited kind of sunlight over kind of the span of the year. And that also starts to give a kind of specific kind of angle or that starts to begin to articulate that in relationship to the kind of heights that are then, let's say, about programmatic placement or kind of building typology that are needed within that kind of field. But the kind of figure ground relationship, that is more on the kind of dealt with more within the kind of the other kind of systems, the other environmental systems or kind of ecological systems that were there or present on that kind of in that project. Yeah, I mean, you know, that isn't just to say that it's only going to be about the kind of vegetation, but any other kind of species that were there, including the human species as well, and their kind of default mechanisms. I mean, having the city grid within that project is more about breaking up the plot, making it manageable within this kind of what we're being asked to produce, which is a master plan, but it also allows for kind of vehicular traffic to kind of like work. But the primary kind of relationship was to also look at a more sustainable kind of opportunity that doesn't work at 100% efficiency, but works at maybe a kind of 50 or 60% efficiency to kind of maybe readdress how the city should work for a kind of population which isn't so large, bringing in kind of cycling lanes and paths and such.
Philip, I just wondered, would you mind extending that subject, like the very similar subject, to the discussion which we always have in architecture, somewhere located between the function of delight and the function of figures and politics and optimization, because I think your project is probably the most sensual and aesthetically delightful from what we've seen today.
The question of optimism is
optimization.
Really,
I'm sorry.
Well, I'll use the word optimism. allow me, please.
Yes.
Optimism.
Sure.
Eh? That's such a poignant one, isn't it? You know,
yeah.
I mean, sitting here today in these times, to use such a word, and naturally, one questions whether that's naive, irresponsible, blind, or whether such a word might be used really deliberately and effectively. And it seems to me that we've been through an absolutely horrible century. You know, sure, we needed to have the revolution in the teens of the 20th century. Sure, those revolutions. So very full of hope in their time, the revolution 1917, let's say the political one, happened for a reason, happened because of a hidebound world that was impacted and stuck before it, a kind of solid elite of aristocracy and capital that created such a sort of solid mass that could be that needed somehow to be opened, and yet a kind of truly traumatic kind of polarization of this past century of moving back and forth between left and right, between one territory or another, the kind of requirement to choose has produced such a viscerally kind of traumatic series of generations that our parents have experienced, that it really does become a poignant question, the sense of motivation, of purpose. And it seems to me that the craft of optimism is a really an intriguing one to foster, the sense of fertility and of fostering possibility. And I wonder whether if you'll indulge me, I'll translate that into the earlier question about education and about paradigms, because it seems like it's almost a natural thing, perhaps like the visionary picture on the front of the magazine that happened according to your work, this sense of the new tomorrow, of a new century of a design education for architecture. Perhaps it's an absolutely natural thing to do when we're still at the advent of the new century. So what about speaking of life, you know, or ecology, and speaking of those terms as being a design space? I love the definition of ecology, oikos meaning home, you know? I mean, in other words, an involved system, systems that we are a part of, that we live with, rather different in tone, let's say, than a system of 50 years ago, where we might be very intrigued with how dynamics put together and how we can find software processes and cybernetics and see machines start to work. But the kind of felt impacts of a system understood as ecology or as a near living system seems to be a real potent kind of mode for a new architecture, and that in turn then fosters the need for some new languages, certainly. Mm. Moving building perhaps on finite element analysis and fluid realms and interconnectedness, but moving rather beyond simple models of metabolism for architecture. I mean, you know, if I think, okay, you know, it was a miracle to have a one-stroke engine, the locomotive, where just the momentum of the mass after the locomotive lurches into motion under the steam revolution a couple hundred years ago, generates this incredible sense of mechanism, where the two-stroke engine or the four-stroke engine kind of massing together homogeneous things that will be effective. What about finding the combinations of things that start to fuel each other, so that we could really understand the kind of multiplicity of disciplines that have just been spoken of, or perhaps in models or in practice, and get a sense of their economy, get a sense of the language of resilience that can come from multiple elements feeding each other and buffering each other, the kind of language that comes from an economy of complementary systems feeding each other, so that we might start to understand simple things like fires as being sources of life, not just consumption. So we might be able to see whole systems running. And it just seems to me that fosters a kind of language that can give people traction. And then designers can start to see impacts in really quite resilient ways, not simply in terms of the sober expense of achieving something grand, but at what cost, but rather also in terms of creating fertility. And that in turn then raises the very poignant question that my colleague Kevin raised this morning about a kind of a Cambrian explosion of fertility being invited, but at the same time with a mortality function, so that there can be selection and cycling through it, so that clearing out can happen. And that's a tremendously difficult question. The kind of incredible encouragement that would allow such a garden to happen, but without visiting a kind of eugenics or you know, horrific kind of cancer function that would be needed in order to keep such a thing moving, but rather the kind of many small actions of contraction and selection and staged mortality and cost and measurement that might engender a kind of fertility. So now I'm trying to talk about not just an expansion, but also a critical kind of culture working directly in parallel with the kind of productive and engineering and industrial engineering culture of generation. And that, to my mind, seems like a brilliant model for a school. So what I'm trying to talk about then is the craft of putting fact and fiction very deliberately together in a productive loop that might make for a very, very optimistic design curriculum.
Thank you.
That was a different scale than intimacy, I'm sorry.
That's right. I also think that's very interesting what we experience here, because we see drawings from you guys and also the drawings from Philip that remind me very much the drawings that you saw at the Bartlett or the AA in the 90s and also in the 2000s and still in Columbia and all these schools. And still those drawings haven't really been accepted by the AIA or the RABA, so I'm a little bit concerned of that. But that might be a slightly different subject. Interstitial spaces, before I throw this to the audience, I would like to address to Michael, because you guys showed the project by Chumi, where it sort of hangs over the existing structure. This is an accident that happened, that you had there, like interstitial spaces that can be used by multiple cultures or ecologies. I mean, it's not been designed like this. And the other thing is, if you provide interstitial spaces or niches for, let's say, birds and bats and so on, is that really beneficial for the human being that lives in there, or the building structure? Or do we need to find out how we design for pigeons, as you mentioned at one stage?
I think there are several things that perhaps need to be addressed initially separately. And I think the question of the envelope of L'Œuvre Noire, or the question of figure ground, is one of exhausted dualisms. In a way, if you look at the history of architecture, I don't think that figure ground is inescapable. In fact, from the very early settlements like Çatalhöyük in Turkey, you see that buildings are clustered up into a continuous fabric, and that the roof surfaces begin to establish a new datum. And this is done for several purposes, among others defense, so that you have a perimeter around the aggregation of architecture, but that you have a new plane that can be continuously inhabited, and you enter the buildings from the top. Likewise, the courtyards, mm-hmm. and the courtyards are actually partly made to house goats and sheep and so on, particularly when there is an attack. So this question of continuous planes, the question of the kind of artificial dualism between figure and ground, or inside and outside, is an interesting one to challenge. And Chumi's project is interesting because what is done there, I would elaborate around the notion of an auxiliary architecture. There's an existing building, but there is a need that exceeds somehow the capacity of this building, and a new and open envelope is laid around that. And we will find that this will become more and more a necessary thing to do in architecture today, as we need to re-equip buildings that cannot be taken down at the rate that we may wish and replaced at the rate that we may wish. Take, for instance, all the dismal housing projects across Europe from a particular kind of era that still need to be there because people need to be housed, but they need to be equipped with perhaps an additional other envelope that improves on the climate performance of the building, or that provides much needed extra social space, but in contact and in exchange with the exterior environment in order to increase the range of use of these kinds of spaces, i.e. a space where somebody can go and smoke because it's not allowed there, or where you prepare your skis because it's nasty to have the resin or whatever, the wax inside. So the point what I'm trying to get at is that trying to challenge some of these inherited artificial dualisms and looking back at architectural history, but also looking forward to the kind of future that we wish to project, gives the possibility to then say, if we have particular desires in the design or design problems that we want to tackle, i.e. the integration of different species, is there a new space that is emerging when we begin to think of the ground as probably as a duplicated or deep condition, and when we think about the envelope as a duplicated deep interstitial residual or whatever terminology one might want to use, and bring with it also a certain kind of connotation in relation to other kinds of works. But for Chumi, I think the notion of event could be nicely extended from the human to a multi-species event space. And so gaining consciousness of these kinds of possibilities, yes, then you would actually make an extra provision for bats, or an extra provision for pigeons, or an extra provision for the kind of species that you really would like to see, because you have realized that the opportunity is there, and that these structures are, unless you do something really severe, these structures are being populated and inhabited by other species.
Thank you. Questions from the audience? The young gentleman in red.
This question is, I think, one all of you can address, but I think it's particularly applicable to some of Philip's installations. And the question is, in the process of forming the kind of cyclical and symbiotic ecologies that you design, how do you approach the necessary element of natural selection in evolving that final product? And what would you suggest to a student as we approach this issue in our design process?
Well, the concept of natural selection is such a poignant one, isn't it? I mean, in the sense of perhaps having a picture of fit things winning and other things losing, and needing to get to the very best possible result because there's a sense of a caustic or acidic surround that you need to be able to stand up to, and your progeny needs to be able to survive. I mean, if there's that kind of projection of a milieu that your work as a kind of a steward is being projected into. On the other hand, if it's possible somehow to foster a cycle so that one isn't caught in the absolute artificial stance, the imposed stance of having to take a single stand, but rather if one's able to see something cycling through in many iterations, so that one can have the kind of confidence of involvement and experience, rather than the disability of something being only a simulation and being anxious about whether it's going to perform, or on the other hand, one on only being a builder and not having the computational ability of great simulation that might make it more powerful. I mean, any point along that cycle in itself speaks of disability. But when if one goes through cycles of development, then those kind of individual stances become quite artificial and unnecessary insecurities. And so practical working methods such as the practice of thinking of things and then simulating and then projecting and then detailing and then prototyping and going through proof of concept and then beating it up and deliberately breaking it and cycling that through in order to have the kind of resilience of experience of multiple cycles is a tremendously enabling kind of craft. And if one does that enough, then perhaps we can, with quite a lot of conviction, speak about fostering our own kind of natural selection. that is of fitness testing through possibility searching, and subjecting to involvement. I'd like to think so. You know, I think that there can be design practices that are tremendously involved and generative through those kind of examples. And you know, Mitch's invocation of the cheap fabbers is one example of that. The kind of kitchen sink approach. One doesn't have to be too ambivalent about that either, in the sense of that fostering a disability, because one can access military economies as well. One simply doesn't have to choose. We don't have to worry so much about loyalties where we choose one thing or another. Instead, I'd rather kind of hold a model as being something like at least a T, you know, if not a T with multiple descenders. That is, to really celebrate the craft of being a dilettante and being a generalist. Kind of lateral move, along with some silos, however many there are, and to think of that kind of stuttering kind of model of involvement as being tremendously enabling and complementary.
More questions? It's your last chance for today with this crowd. There's one over there.
I personally have great expectations because I think there are two or three lessons to be learned from architects that are absolutely significant in the pursuit of some of the things that we're discussing here. Some is to do with the inhabitation of one or several continuous planes, cohabitation. And the other one is also, I think, one of the critical points put forward by Mike Wells last night. And that is somehow the seasonal changes and the changes in appearance, maybe the changes in productivity, maybe the changes in interaction that need to be taken into consideration, that today rests outside of what architects think about, because the moment the climate envelope is established, we are more concerned with how we organize some sort of interior environment. And the question of the extended threshold is where landscape architecture and architecture sort of meet. So yeah, from my point of view, at least the expectations are great. I hope to learn a lot from you guys.
I think it's a, I mean, it's a super exciting time to be doing landscape architecture. I actually am really jealous of the field. In fact, to the point, if I had more time in my life, I would spend another 2 years and get that degree as well. But I don't see a kind of a purpose anymore to creating discipline boundaries. Mm. Even though landscape architecture is an autonomous field and there's a good century of folks that have defined it more or less, I think landscape architects should certainly feel comfortable designing an automobile. I think that automobile designers should maybe try out their hand on maybe looking at cities or maybe designing an ecology. You know, architects could probably think about doing the landscape. I think the more shared you are in your field, or the more sharing you are in your field, the kind of more creativity and the more innovation is going to be kind of the end product or the resultant of such things. You know, there's clearly a merger, at least in Harvard, with when you think about landscape urbanism, Charles Waldheim, et cetera, where the urban design slash planning degrees are kind of embedded in landscape and ecology. And even though they are different subsets, and you could make all kinds of arguments about how they can be broken down into cellular conditions, it is just it's really hard to say this is a boundary for the architect, this is a boundary for the landscape architect. I've seen both folks in different directions take on or tackle those objectives and do it just as good as someone else from the opposing field. So actually some of our best architectural designs and landscape designs came from a biologist and a chef in our group, people that technically know nothing about either field. And you never think that would happen, but they kind of stun us with these kind of physical models that they produce. And somehow we were, you know, through all our training and understanding of the kind of historical background for some of these projects, never made those moves. And or we would think they were ugly were kind of a fail of production or naive, but yet were groundbreaking. And I think that there, you know, it's just to hammer home the point, the limitation that we have these disciplines is very difficult, especially in this day and age. I just think that there certainly should be a lot more bleeding between the two, and there has been.
Thank you very much.
Maybe I can just pick up on your comments as well, and I want to speak about landscape architecture, and then use that to loop back into your first question, or a question I heard about pleasure. We've heard comments about figure and ground relations today, and if there is a question of how to gain traction in connectedness, into interconnected systems, then it seems to me that as architects, the parallel discipline of landscape architecture could not be more important and significant and available to us as the primary kind of discipline, the natural one, in which to discover the anatomy of the ground if architects are designers of figures in history. So, I mean, when we think of kind of natural languages, natural enabling design languages of landscape architecture as design of space, then of course we can start with the population of fluid and apparently homogeneous spaces with species, with the orchestration of overlapping increments of space as being natural languages. We can also think of the temporal dimensions, I mean, of working with time, of working with multiple stages of that space. And we can think of constituent parts and metabolisms and equations, stoichiometry, that is the counting of chemical pieces, of chemical effluents, of chemical reactions, so that we can see how those spaces behave and perform and exchange and impact others. So it seems to me that the natural design languages that are already practiced in landscape architecture have a huge significance, a potential significance in enabling the expanded practice of architecture itself. Now, when I think about that applied to the models, the wonderful models that my colleagues here have just offered, I mean, the revolutionary, I mean, well, revolution, I mean, just the kind of radical porosity that's envisioned at the Brooklyn Navy Yard in that kind of vision of an integrated city, or the language of transitional spaces that you both just offered us, I mean, an incredibly enabling kind of assembly of ways that architecture can behave additively in an expanded field, rather than working just with the polarization of nature versus city or building versus site. Then it seems to me that we could take the thought about landscape craft and move into a language of transitional spaces wholeheartedly. And that loops me back to your question about pleasure, because in contrast to Freud's kind of discussion of the pleasure principle as being something infantile and, you know, only a baby would be obsessed with, you know, and then when we grow up, we can be clear of such emotion-bound, such kind of feeding kind of bodily-based realms and move into our head, into safe, dry territory instead. And I wonder whether we might reclaim the term infantile and see it as an enormously empowering, positive, beautiful state of a path into our limbic centers, of a path into the formative elements that make up living systems, and through being acutely sensitive by inhabiting our infantile states, then perhaps that might engender a scale of values that would produce a near-living architecture. And accompanying then the reclaiming of the word infantile perhaps might be a reclaiming of the word ambivalent, because I've been taught that to be ambivalent is terribly weak. I have to decide, don't I? You know, perhaps the word ambivalent could be a sign, the queasy, uncanny sensation of experience ambivalence might be a sign that we are acquiring a sense of the multiple perspectives of the situation, that we are embodying the kind of turbulence of different impacts in understanding things. Perhaps it might be a kind of a body map response, an infantile body map response, to say that we are starting to grasp the subtlety of things in order to be able to become responsible and to engender for the dimensions to them. So anyway, maybe those terms could be reclaimed towards this kind of transitional state.
Can I just pick up on something at the expense of coming across as conservative? I would like to just say something about the relation of, or the value of disciplinary specificity in a context where we, at least from an institutional point of view, seem to embrace interdisciplinarity and transdisciplinarity and so on. And I admire the efforts that are going on in New York to place certain lines of inquiry outside of constraining environments in order to go forward. However, I do believe when a chef makes a car, it is still useful for a car maker, and the sensibility and critical ability of that person to moderate the output, given that this person is not constrained by inherited forms of knowledge that prevent innovation, i.e. figure ground what we tend to inherit and so on. So I think we have to be careful that we don't swing to the other extreme of discarding the need for kind of moderation of a kind of critical ability that makes the fresh eye and the fresh view actually able to proceed in a kind of economic way, I would say. And in a way that is related to the possibility of turning things around within a kind of given time frame.
I just wanted to offer one quick thought that I was last fall I was invited to speak to the incoming freshman class at Columbia University, and what resonated very much with this young generation just starting college now. But I said to them, when you enter college today, don't worry so much about what you're going to be your major, because none of you have one single career in your life. You probably have 5 or 10, and so pile as much knowledge as you can, and then you will choose. And then that's true for a lot of us here in this room. So you know that we can try different disciplines. Nobody will stay really one. It's very hard to stay because you need to have a lot of versatile skills and knowledge to operate within cities. So I'm not that concerned about one single discipline.
Thank you very much, everybody. Okay. We've taken much longer than we should have, but I think it was quite interesting.